Is this one on too? Thank you very much. Next up, we have, let me actually make a couple quick comments, which we didn't get out this morning. For people that want to follow along online on the back channel, we have the Libra Planet IRC channel on Freenode. And we also have, of course, the LibraPlanet.org wiki. And for anybody that feels so inclined, if you want to keep any of your notes about any of these talks right up on the wiki, on your user page or anywhere else, that would be great and helps us build something lasting that comes out of this conference. Next, I want to welcome Benjamin Mako Hill, who is a board member of the Free Software Foundation, has been an important part of the autonomous working group that's been looking at free network services, and has been a really key influence for free software on a lot of projects like Debian and Ubuntu and the free culture community. So let me welcome Mako, who's going to talk about free network services.
Okay. All right. Well, Matt's setting that up. I'll just say that let me apologize in advance for my voice and maybe any sluggishness. I've managed to, of course, come down with a pretty bad cold in the last couple of days and a sinus infection. So I'm a little off, but I'll try my best. All right. So in any case, last year, I mean, so it might be good for me to get an idea. Who here was at the FSF members meeting last year and saw that? Okay, so most, but not everyone, maybe a little more than half. So last year I gave a talk about software freedom and network services, and I did it the day before the FSF sort of convened a meeting of a handful of people. Who here was at the meeting the next day? A few people? I see two, three, four, a few people who were there. To talk about sort of software freedom and network services and sort of what it means. So what I'm going to do first is, for those of you who weren't here last year, haven't been following this, I'm going to try to pretty quickly sort of summarize that process and how we sort of went through it, and talk a little bit about sort of why this is something that the FSF is interested in, at least sort of to make sure we all have that sort of grounding. And then what I'll do is I'll sort of introduce basically our activities in the last year, so what the FSF and this sort of group of people who are around the FSF have been working on and thinking about freedom and network services. So I'll talk about Anonymous, and I'll talk in particular about this a document called the Franklin Street Statement on Software Freedom and Network Services, which is not an FSF document, but it is an attempt at sort of getting a first, making a first stab at describing what we think might be qualities or guidelines to think about in terms of software freedom and network services. And then what I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about an ongoing conversation that we've been having inside the FSF about the Franklin Street Statement, about freedom and network services, and about what we think where we think we're going. So this is a little bit premature in the sense that the FSF hasn't sort of made an explicit statement on this, so this is stuff that could change and stuff that we're still thinking through. But hopefully, by talking to all of you today and then tomorrow in the as we sort of move into sort of the more unconference space, we can actually move forward to some of these conversations and we can actually help refine our thinking on this this topic and help make real progress. So. First things first, you guys still work? All right, yeah, you keep going, it's fine. I don't need it for a while, probably. So, in any case, to sort of throw down some sort of context here, there's been a lot of talk in the free software community around network services, and this is in part because there's been rapid, and I won't say unprecedented growth, but there's been a rapid growth in the use of network services in general, sort of, and a shift towards centralized computing. Now, we might say this is unprecedented because certainly these types of network applications are, and I'll give you know the type, Craig and Sitterker describes this great pendulum of computing, where the idea was we start, you know, you work it was first mainframes, you know, and then you move to mini computers, and then you had like terminals, and sort of this is back and forth. But we're moving into a place where an increasingly large number of applications that we use do not run on our computers. And you don't have to look far to see this. If you look at what people, I mean, there are some of these, I guess they're kind of spyware companies that sort of like monitor everything that people do on their computers, and then they can tell us with some degree of accuracy what people are doing. What people are doing when they use their computers these days frequently is interacting with web applications, and frequently with a very small number of applications. Right? People spend a lot of time on Google and a bunch of its products. People spend a huge amount of time on Facebook and MySpace, eBay, with I think around 4%, Wikipedia with about 0.5% of all time spent online. And this time spent online is an increasingly large fraction of the time that people spend with their computers, right? So when people are computing, right, when they're using software, they increasingly frequently are using network software. They're using software that they don't have access to. They're using software that doesn't run on their computer. They're using software that they can't change, that they can't use, that they can't control. And of course, that's a relevant point for people that care about software freedom, because it marks an important shift in the power relationships that users have with their computers and with their software. So the other thing that's worth noting is that there's a shift between a bunch of applications which have historically been done offline, right? So sometimes this is called software as a service, right? This idea that a lot of software that that people used to run on their own computers, they're now able to connect to a website and run the same application. So, for example, people are using instant messaging systems. They used to install clients on their own computer, and now they just go to Meebo.com or one of these websites and use it that way. And this is an increasingly common way for a lot of people to use it. So, Google Docs, if people have used that, is another example of something that does this, although it also offers some cooperation features and collaboration features that aren't in existing systems. So in any case, this represents an important shift in power relationships between users and their software for a variety of reasons. A shift towards more centralized services for software represents a shift in control over software in some important ways. It represents a shift in control of one's private data. If one is running software that runs on their own computer, they have control of their own data, right? No one has access to their data. If you're running software that runs on someone else's computer, then that person controls your data in ways that you don't even. And in many cases, when people are using network services, their data that is often data that that they don't even have access to all the time. And as we use these services for a variety of services, one sort of democratic processes, one's market environment, one sort of technological environment, all control over all of these aspects, insofar as they're mediated by the technology that we're using, become controlled by the people who are running that software. And as that software is increasingly not run by us, we the users of software are increasingly disempowered. So. This, of course, is where free software comes in, because from my perspective, and I say this almost every time I talk about free software, but I think it's important to remember, it's important for me to remember, and I think it's important for a lot of us to remember that free software is about, and the reason it's different than open source, for example, is because it's about power, and it's about control, and it's about autonomy, right? It's the example I like to give is this idea of sort of a communication technology, that all technology has particular affordances, that all technology works in particular ways. If I want to send a message to someone and I want to use my phone, right, I'm able to send a particular message. If I can type a text message, it's going to be short. If I can send a picture, it's going to be, I don't know, it's going to involve a different message, right? That every technology that we use has particular affordances, right? And those affordances determine really quite explicitly what we can say, who we can say, how we can say it, who we can say it to, right? It's technological control is hugely important to determining the way that we can communicate. And insofar as our lives are increasingly mediated by technology, our experience is under control of the people who control our software, and that's why control is important, and that's why it's an important and that's why this is an important question. Now, in the context of network services, what's interesting is that in some cases, it seems like as we use the software very differently, even though we may continue to have access to source code, things are more complicated because the issues of control haven't changed. So, excuse me. All right. So in any case, the I don't know what's going on up here, but in any case, the first thing that the FSF did, and I'm still working through sort of giving a little bit of background and context. The first thing that the FSF sort of noticed that this issue that I've talked about in terms of user control wasn't even our only problem, and in some cases it wasn't the most obvious, or at least not the most obvious to fix. This problem in relation to user control over network services. The first and most obvious issue, as people increasingly began to use free software to take free software programs, free software, especially software under the GPL, and use it under and use it in these network services, was that copyleft, right? This thing which has this concept and a very important part of the GPL, which has led to a really thriving free software community, kind of stopped working in the context of lots of network services. And the reason this happened was pretty simple. It was that the GPL requires that source for software is distributed with software. But that implies that the software is itself distributed, right? So people can download and modify it, and people can download and modify pieces of free software. And if they never distribute the software, then they never have to distribute. Then they never have to distribute the changes to their software. Up until reasonably recently, this was a sort of, there was a convenient, it was convenient that using software in almost all cases meant that if you were able to use software, it's because you had software. But as people move towards sort of network services, as people become more connected, then it's no longer necessary to necessarily have the piece of software that you want in order to run it. All you need is a web browser. You go somewhere, and you never need to have the software. The result was that people who wanted to could take pieces of free software, GPL software, they could download them, they could modify them, and then they could set them up on a website, and they would never have to provide modified versions of the source code to their users or to the larger sort of community of users and developers, right? So this was the first. This was a problem that was recognized, must have been 6 or 7 years ago, I guess in the first version, the first time. And initially, Henry Poole and Bradley Kuhn worked to release a version of. I guess we can go back. Yeah. So to release a version of a license called the Afero General Public License. In 2002, so I guess it was 6 years ago, and which basically said that any modified AGPL web service, that any user of one of these modified applications should have access to the source code. So simple enough. This was eventually sort of, there were plans to sort of incorporate it into the GPL v3. Eventually, the decision was made to incorporate it into continue keeping it in a separate license, the Afero General Public License. But the FSF sort of took over stewardship of the license, released this. I talked about this at the last members meeting, so it must have been within about 2 years ago. Released the license. And then also when the GPL v3 was released, it involved a compatibility clause, so the people who'd released applications under the GPL v3 would be able to take code and either put it under the AGPL, or they were able to use GPL libraries from AGPL applications. So that's this has been successful for a whole set of reasons. It solved this problem that developers' desires are respected. So when people release code and expect people to contribute back, that's respected. It meant that the community gets to improve their software, and it means that people aren't discouraged from releasing code with the idea that someone can just take it and put it into a proprietary network service. So these are all very good things. But unfortunately, and this is sort of worth reiterating, it became increasingly clear to a number of people in the free software community and in the FSF that the AGPL and similar approaches only addressed sort of the smaller and in some cases the least important the less important half of the problem of network services. This goes back to sort of how I introduced this, right? Because even with accessible source code, right, the users of many network services remain far from free. Users can still control their computing in can still not control their computing in many situations. That having access to the sort, and a couple examples can illustrate this, right? Having access to the source code for Google or Facebook doesn't actually help anyone very much. Because you don't have access to the server farms necessary to run it. More importantly, you don't have access to the data necessary to make it work. And even if you did have access to the data necessary to make something like, certainly something like Facebook work, your friends would all would not be using it. So there's a whole set of complicated issues around what freedom might mean in this situation, because the typical methods that we've used, the sort of release the source code and we'll be free, seem to not work, or at least not work as cleanly in at least some of these situations. And the result, and the situation is sort of complex. We've sort of taken this idea that users should be able to control their computing, right? It's a nice statement, but it ends up being complicated in the world of network services, right? So. Sure, one can control one's computing if it's on one system. All right, that makes sense. But what does it mean for Wikipedians to control Wikipedia's computing, right? What is one's computing in the context of a large aggregate sort of work? What is in services where the whole benefit is that you have the sort of network effect? What does it mean for an individual user to have control over that service, right? What does it mean in terms of everyone else? Who does Facebook belong to? Who does Wikipedia belong to? Is the source enough? Source and data, et cetera, right? It's a funny situation because, in a weird sense, although we're sort of, the free software community is sort of famous, it's this sort of archetypical example of a sort of collaborative community, right? Our methods have been very sort of highly individualistic, and when it comes to works that don't belong to a single person, maybe, but belong to everyone else, we actually don't really know what to do, in some situations. So. That's sort of where I left off last year. I guess it was kind of a funny place to leave off. It's like, yeah, there's this big problem. Yeah, it'd be nice if we could solve that. So I wish I could report that we'd solved it all, but I think that I can report that we've made some progress. So the day after, I mean, it was kind of funny. I gave the talk sort of 24 hours early on network services last year, because the day after we took a bunch of people who'd come here for the members meeting and who'd sort of people who'd been writing about or thinking about network services and sort of spending a lot of time in this space. And who were sort of free software advocates and who were interested in software freedom and thinking about these issues. When we brought them together, we sort of said, all right, let's think through these issues. And one of the things that we did was we actually took a big list of examples of applications, examples that we thought were pretty good examples, like Wikipedia, that's a good, or Facebook or Gmail or something like that. And we sort of talked through what we thought the issues were, why we thought those issues existed, and sort of worked from there. The group is called Autonomous, I guess it's up there. You can see it. It's spelled with a dot. It's a URL. It's kind of like a Web 20 thing. But Autonomous, because we wanted to focus, start talking about what it meant to what autonomy meant in this space, what autonomy for a group means, what autonomy for a network service means. How can we sort of think through these sort of issues? And what's important to sort of point out, and I think that. It's worth pointing out that this is sort of a group of people who are all sort of very sympathetic to the idea of software freedom and network services, but who are not. Henry Poole and I were sort of involved. We're on the board of the FSF, but it wasn't. It's not an FSF project per se. And I should say that also because I'm sort of standing up here and as a at least in whatever capacity I can represent the FSF. I should make it clear that Autonomous is not the FSF, but it's an interesting model of one of the ways that the FSF is trying to approach sort of this difficult issue, and I think it's kind of an interesting idea there as well, because the FSF has, of course, traditionally been this organization that sort of speaks thinks along, internally, talk out, and thinks about very difficult and issues related to sort of freedom, and then sort of speaks and says, yes, this is, I mean, like, defines, this is what free software is, right? Successfully, and I think with pretty important sort of results, and says, these are the licenses that people should use. So Autonomous was an organization which was sort of created outside the FSF, although sort of with FSF support, because the idea was is that we didn't feel that we had, unlike issues of software freedom, what software freedom means, where the FSF thinks we actually have a pretty good idea of what that means. Like, we made the term up, so... But I have a pretty good idea of what it means. We don't because we weren't assured, we decided to work outside, to work with a broader community than usually works on these things, and to sort of provide a space on a different website, autonomo.us, which is a blog where people have posted basically articles and a couple podcasts thinking and talking about network services, all of which I think inform the FSF sort of decision-making on this issue, but some of which even, I mean, there were just important disagreements among the group of people who are sort of posting there, which I think is sort of an interesting model for the FSF to pursue, because it's a way of sort of thinking out loud outside of the organization, with the idea being that it can inform those sort of decision-making. So we're going to sort of, so I'll talk a little bit about what Autonomous has done first, and then I'll come back and give you a preview of what the FSF is doing with what Autonomous has been doing. So the most important outcome of the Autonomous meeting, and I think of Autonomous in the first year, was this document called the Franklin Street Declaration on Freedom and Network Services, I believe is the full name. And I've sort of put it up here. We can go through it pretty quickly. The idea was basically a set of guidelines. And of course, these are not FSF policy. The FSF has not endorsed the Franklin Street Statement, but has certainly thought a lot about it. And I'll show you where that's sort of gone. But the basic idea I've got the whole document up here. It's a set of guidelines for developers, service providers, and users of network services that sort of is supposed to give a set of ideas of what we think good practices are. This was sort of the consensus of the group. We didn't agree on everything, but these are the things we did agree on. One was the first group we sort of spoke to was developers, and we suggested that developers use the AGPL, the Affero General Public License, and I think we could probably change that to be another license that has the same effect. I don't know of one. But a license designed specifically for network service software to ensure that users of services have the ability to examine the source and implement their own services. Developers, we also encourage to make freely licensed alternatives to existing popular non-free network services, right? Also very important, to develop software that can replace centralized services and data storage with distributed software and data deployment, giving control back to users. This idea being that even in a world that with many network services, if you're still dependent on someone else to run your application for you, you are inherently in less control of your own, of your own computing than if you are running your software. So in many cases, how do we, we can say you might want to run an alternative to a network service. We can tell a user that they might want to consider running an alternative to a network service. So, for example, if they're running Meebo as their IAM client, we say maybe you want to download Pigeon and use that instead, a freely available alternative which does the same thing. Hard to do for, we can't say download the Facebook application and use that instead of having to use the website, right? But maybe if we think about how one might develop an application that does that, and there'll be some discussion about that later this afternoon, then we can make that statement. So that's an important way forward. We asked service providers. We also spoke to service providers, the second group. We asked them to choose free software for their service. Fair enough. To release customizations of their software under a free software license. Just being good community members. To make and also to make data and works of authorship available to the services users under terms and in formats that allow users to move and use their data outside the service. Basically, this means that users should have control of their private data, and that data that's available to everyone should be available to everyone under terms that allow them to use it and reuse it. What this means is, of course, that a service provider who releases a service in this way will allow any user of the service to sort of fork, in a sense, right? If they become bad, or if they decide to change, or if they just can no longer run the service, then presumably any user or could become a service provider themselves. They'd be able to take their own data and publicly available data and reproduce it elsewhere. So These were our recommendations to service providers. And then finally, our recommendations for users were to, first, consider very carefully whether to use software on someone else's computer at all, right? So this is what I was alluding to earlier, that the choice of whether to use a network service is an important one. And if it's possible, you should use a free software equivalent that runs on your own computer. And then also pointed out that in deciding to use a network service, look for services that sort of try to use services that are working more towards supporting the free software community and respecting user freedom and these sorts of ideas. So that was the Franklin Street statement. It was endorsed by quite a number of people and was an important sort of step forward, I think, in terms of being really explicit about what we think software freedom might be. Now, in the realm of network services. Now, the FSF has been, internally, the FSF has been thinking about this for a while and considering sort of how it wants to move forward with it. And we've been actually working on a draft of a document, which is actually built very explicitly on the Franklin Street Statement. But it adds to it in a couple important ways, and I can talk about that. So I should also say that this is, of course, not FSF policy. It's just sort of but it's a window into our sort of thinking, and I hope that it's also an invitation to speak with myself and with the other FSF board members and staff at the FSF about this policy and about how we should be thinking about this going forward. So, excuse me. So the first and most important thing that we were thinking about that we've been discussing is the idea that there really are different classes of network services, and that's something that was implicit in the Franklin Street Statement as well, right? You say consider using different ones, but what are the factors that one might consider? And the most important distinction between different types of applications was this idea between what was sort of we're calling, and many other people have called, sort of software as a service and other types of network applications. So software as a service, of course, is at least as we're explicitly referring to it, meaning this practice is sort of providing substitutes for software that runs on a user's computer with software that runs on a server. This is that in many ways, this is the sort of easiest class of the easiest class of network services to deal with, because these really are just applications that one can choose to either run locally or one that can choose to run remotely. And if one runs them remotely, they will be, even if it is free software, even if they have access to the data, they will be inherently disempowered. So what we're by breaking it up into the streets, we can deal with them separately. It's important to note for example, things like search engines or Wikipedia or Facebook, for that matter, are not software as a service in the sense that in the way that we are using the term, but they are network services. So we're referring to them as a sort of subset. And the reason we do this is because that there are sort of very very important practical and ethical implications of software as a service, is service in particular. So our first recommendation is going to be that for software as a service, the situation is pretty clear. Users who want to live in freedom must reject any use of software as a service. If the program is free software, then the software being run is under the service provider's control, but it's never under the user's control. So users should reject that. And where possible, they should develop or release free software to do the same jobs as the programs that are offered only as software as a service, right? If it were free software, then this is pretty easy. We can just download it and sort of distribute it. So be really clear on that sort of distinction. That was the first sort of step. And then the second two things that we're doing is, one, prioritizing those different actions. The Franklin Street Statement is this list of things that we think people should do, as we've thought about this, not everything on that list is sort of equally important, or more importantly, it's not equally applicable to all situations. So being really so we had sort of two goals going forward. One is to prioritize these different types of actions, right? To say this is, so for example, in software and the service, in situations where someone is talking about software and the service, it's more straightforward. We can be really explicit there. And the second thing we can do is to make it really clear why certain actions are possible. So the Frankenstein statement says, do this, do this, do this, but it doesn't actually sort of connect those actions to the real freedom benefits that people are going to be sort of reaping from this potentially, right? So we've been really explicit about that, so we can understand both what doing these things, like, you know, releasing stuff under the AGPL does, but also so we can understand what it doesn't do, because of course, you know, there are real limits to everything in that list. So we can say, for example, that most network services do not fall into the category of software as a service, so rejecting them outright is not necessary for maintaining your freedom. However, these services can potentially have other problems. The most reliable way to prevent these problems is to avoid the need for a common service, so we recommend the developers first develop software that can replace centralized network services and data storage with distributed software and data development. So again, something coming from the Franklin Street Statement. But we also point out that users who carry out network services, service providers can take steps to reduce some of the problems raised by network services and to help support free software communities. This is, of course, most of what the AGPL does. Is it supports free software communities who are helping build applications by being more cooperative and collaborative, and which can help give competitive advantages to the services which are going to be more free and going to empower users to build things. So we can do things like recommend the use of the AGPL and recommend that people develop and release freely licensed alternatives. And then we can, of course, explicitly sort of point out that there's a class of recommendations which are in the Franklin Street Statement, which are basically trying to avoid mistreatment of users by giving them control over their data. We point that out, but also point out the limitations to this, right? That control over one's data is itself kind of an interesting term, right? Does that mean that one has access to it? Certainly, right? You want to be able to export it. What about keeping other people from having access to it, right? And there's this problem that in many network services, for example, there are legal requirements. The government can show up and say, give us all of your data, and there's nothing that a third party can do, and sometimes they can't even tell the user that it's done. So making explicit that even in situations where a service provider has the best intentions, that there are real limitations to over what a user might be able to do. But we end up making I think all of the same in the current draft, at least we're making all the same recommendations, but in this sort of different way where we're doing making these sorts of distinctions and prioritizations. So this is an ongoing process. We'll see where it ends up. Of course, it's possible that we'll hit a roadblock and we'll have to sit on this for a while longer. But I can say that this issue, network services and software freedom, you know, insofar as it's an increasingly large part of the world of software use, maybe not entirely representative of people in this room, but I think that it is representative of the way that people are using software more broadly, and as a result, this is an issue that the foundation, as an institution, the sort of the board and the staff really care about, because our goal, of course, is not limited to the way that we've produced software in the past, right? We're talking, our issue, ultimately, the Free Software Foundation is about technological empowerment. It's about ensuring that users of software have control over their software. And the fact that it makes things more complicated when people start using their software in very different ways, or developing software in very different ways, because it means that we have to rethink some of the things that we've been able to take for granted for a long time. This is certainly an issue that I and others in the FSF have been putting a lot of energy and thought into it, and I really look forward to continuing this conversation both this afternoon. There'll be at least one more talk on the topic that's a lot more specific, and then also tomorrow in the sort of unconference session, where hopefully we'll be able to make some real progress on some of these important issues, things like building distributed systems, so there's technical issues, there's technical issues. I think this is something that the free software as a community can really come together as a whole and help lead the path forward. So thanks for putting up with me and my voice. I hope to have as much good news to report next year. So thanks, everyone. So yeah, I mean, if there's great. So let's see. So who has questions? Let's if we can, let's go here, 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 here. Okay. So yes. You don't have access to the network?
Yeah, because you have to pay so much for the internet provider all the time. That's where we need the real freedom. I mean, I can go on the road and not have to pay a toll if I choose. I should be able to hear on the internet without a toll. To me, that's the biggest issue with freedom.
I mean, it's absolutely true that access to... there is uneven access to lots of public services, and I think that that is an important issue. I agree. Okay. I mean, no, I absolutely, right?
Yeah.
That's a great point. All right. Yes, up here, and then you, next.
So clearly there are complications here and complexities that go beyond... the simple software freedom issues, but can you now or do you hope to be able to give something comparable to the 4 software freedoms? I mean, maybe they're like the 8 network software freedoms or something. I mean, it would be really helpful to be able to ultimately boil it down. Of course, there are always going to be edge cases and complexities and significances.
So I think that that's absolutely a goal of mine. Now, I think that the most important, we started out, I mean, with explicitly that goal. It was like, great, we're going to bring together, you know, like 8 smart people, and we'll have the definition of network freedom, you know, tomorrow. What we realized early on was that one important issue is that when we say network services, we're actually referring to a really wide variety of different things, right? So I think that the most important steps that we've been taking in the last several months has been being really explicit about what we mean by network service, or if one definition isn't actually if there's not a singular concept of network services that needs to be treated in a particular way, maybe we need to break this up and treat it differently. The idea, I mean, like the analogy would be like that you know, if we don't define what software is, right, then talking about free software is, I mean, and there are people who've defined software differently, right, and have come to very kind of confusing results when they tried to apply issues of software freedom. Yes, it is absolutely a goal of mine to work towards that. That said, it's worth being. I mean, the FSF definitions of what software freedom means in particular situations carry a lot of weight, and it's something that we don't want to get wrong. I think that we're a lot closer to that this year than we were last year. I think that we're making. I think that by that we're able to speak very explicitly about with explicit sort of statements about users who care about freedom in this context must reject software as a service, right? At least as we're defining it in this situation. We're getting close to being able to make making several very explicit statements like that. And I think that as we sort of are able to wrap our head around the world of network services, we're going to be able to speak in terms like definitions about at least parts of these world, and I think that over time we're absolutely getting a better handle on that. So yeah, I mean that's it's absolutely a goal. That said, we're not going to get it wrong. So if that means we take a little bit longer, it's worth doing that. There was a question in the center first, and then there was a question here, and there was a question up there. Okay, yes.
Have you given any thought to voting machines as an application? Some of the manufacturers,
So I've not.
It's a problem.
Absolutely. In fact, not only I've given it, I've also written a free software application for doing voting machinery. So personally. So yes, that's an issue that I care about a lot. There are some important issues with, I mean, like